Hi, and welcome to Kaleidos Science. Here you find answers about cognition that you may or may not have asked yourself. This episode is hosted by Imogen Hüsing and Sophie Kühne. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode.
Before the episode starts, a short disclaimer. Due to technical difficulties, the audio quality might be slightly lower than what you are used to, and some of the sections have background noises. We try to minimize them as much as possible, and we hope that you will enjoy this episode anyway. Have fun!
Welcome to this episode, which is part of a winter special. In this episode, after talking to a lot of science communicators, we will go a little deeper into the science of science communication. And to do that, we would like to welcome Professor Rainer Bronner, who is a professor of psychology at the University of Münster in the area, in the areas of psychology, where he focuses on educational psychology, science education, and science communication. And next to his own research, he is a member of several committees and advisory boards for science communication. Welcome, and thank you for making the time for talking to us.
Thank you for the invitation.
So before we start into the topic of today's episode, we want to play our welcome game as always. And I will start 5 sentences that you then spontaneously complete. The first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be.
I wanted to be a kind of sailor. I wanted to travel around the world.
Nice.
In a large ship, as large as possible.
Very different from what you do now.
And were you ever able to travel on a ship?
No, but my most favorite sport I'm doing is kayaking.
Very nice.
It fits quite well.
The next sentence is, if I was an emoji, I would be.
Ooh. Actually, this is a question for self-hate because I don't like and I don't use emojis. So let me take the emoji who laughs but simultaneously cries.
A favorite of mine, I have to say. The third sentence is, my favorite thing to do on a day off is?
Kayaking.
Nice. And the fourth sentence is, right now I'm most fascinated by?
Oh, I'm still very fascinated by science and by the successes and also sometimes the failures of research. I'm always interested in reading about new findings. Of course, I mean, reading in popular magazines, in all finds, I'm still very fascinated by that.
Nice. That's so cool to see that even after quite a long academic career, there's still curiosity, that there's still the curiosity to learn new things.
Yeah, I think curiosity is the basic, or is one of the basic characteristics or features or attitudes you need to have to do this, to work in this field. I think I came across people who gave me the feeling that they have lost their curiosity, but this often results in kind of a sterile way they do research. So I think it's necessary as a kind of motivator as well as a kind of guideline, so to say.
Yeah. And the last sentence is, I know it's time to call it a day when...
Well, when I'm when I've finished, especially when I managed to finish a paper, that's happy.
Nice.
Okay. Before we start into the main topic, we want to talk a bit more about your scientific journey, your academic journey. So your main field is psychology, and if we read it correctly, you started out more in the realm of teaching and the classroom for your research focus?
Yes, since I, by actually, as it often is the case, more accidentally, after when I finished my diploma in psychology, I got an offer in a German research institute for mathematics education, but there I had the possibility to still to work as a psychologist, and therefore I always had the challenge of finding themes, subjects, research topics which allowed me to keep up a psychological perspective in the context of mathematics education, and that's what I did for nearly 20 years. Simultaneously, I graduated PhD and Habilitation in psychology. And this, in a sense, motivated me to be quite interested in interdisciplinary research on the one hand, but also it sharpened my understanding what it means to be a psychologist. It's like a little bit like if you are a Catholic in a Protestant environment, you learn very much about what it means to be a Catholic. Mm-hmm. I think it's similar.
So you learn more about basically what distincts your research field from other research fields.
Yes.
When you come.
Yes. And since then, I'm very interested in also in other disciplines, in the structures and concepts of other disciplines, and in which ways they differ or are similar to psychology. Yeah.
And when did you start to get involved in research about science communication? Like, when did you kind of shift from science about education to science about science communication?
Well, it was, I started for a long time. I was researching teachers, mathematics and science teachers' cognitions and their professional knowledge. And from that, it is not too far to go to the question, well, what does the general public think about knowledge and science? And in a sense, I could even call an exact date, so to say, when I started with that, I suggested to the German Science Foundation a kind of research program understanding of science and dealing with the public's dealing with conflicting scientific evidence. And this program offered a lot of colleagues and myself to do research in the public understanding of scientific evidence.
That's really cool.
And before, I have to say, I spent some years with a research focus on so-called epistemic beliefs, which is in a sense a kind of metacognitive understanding of of what people think about knowledge. And from there, the next step is then to ask, well, what are people thinking about not knowledge in general, but also, but more special about scientific knowledge.
Yeah, maybe we can go a bit into epistemic beliefs. I mean, could you give a bit more of an explanation of what epistemic beliefs are and maybe where they come from, how they develop?
Yes, there are in the literature there are, so to say, two possible answers. One is an answer where the epistemic beliefs are more or less a kind of metacognitive awareness about one's own knowledge, and there is another account or approach which says no, epistemic beliefs are beliefs or should be conceived as ideas people have about the knowledge of others. And of others means especially of those who have another kind of expertise than you have yourself. And I would say that when it comes to science education, as well as to citizens' capabilities to cope with the everyday, with science in the everyday world, both kinds of epistemic beliefs matter. It's obvious that a kind of understanding of one's own understanding, as and also, by the way, the limits of one's own understanding matter, but also the ideas people have about, for example, researchers, scientists, but also science journalists' ideas about science.
Okay. Can I try and give like two examples for this? Because this idea is currently a little bit abstract for me. So the first thing you talked about is my knowledge about what I think I know. So for example, I don't know, when I'm in the kitchen and I look at the pasta and I know it needs to boil for about 10 minutes, that's me kind of knowing that, and I am aware that I know that. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, yes. But this is an, of course, this is a nice example of what in psychology typically is called metacognition. I know that I know that. I would, and there are colleagues who would argue that simultaneously this is kind of science knowledge, because they, the science of, I mean, it is obviously a, the cooking of pasta is an element which, or is a process which could be understood from a scientific point of view. But I would say no, this is not, if I, as a standing in the kitchen, and have an idea about that, I would not call that as a kind of science which I have. And because I would argue that science is not only content, but it is also a kind of social process and a kind of social institution, meaning it's only if I start to think about concepts where I have the idea, well, this is what scientists might think about cooking, then I would argue this is a kind of epistemic beliefs which are really science-related epistemic beliefs.
Okay. And the second way of epistemic beliefs you talked about is that, for example, I believe that even though I don't understand mathematics particularly well, I believe that the scientists who do the research on that do.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And for example, people often think that it's a very widely widespread assumption that in mathematics, for example, all concepts are always very precisely defined, that there is no variance of the understanding of concepts. And so when I, as a psychologist, for example, started to work in this math education project, I was really, it was quite astonishing for me to learn, for example, that there are huge books in mathematics and in the philosophy of mathematics where it is argued what is a variable, for example. Mm-hmm. The very concept of what is a variable is only in school textbooks. It's quite obvious when it comes to philosophy of mathematics and real mathematics. It is clear there are different approaches, schools, ideas. Of course, there are more prevalent than other ideas, but still there's at least a kind of history of the understanding of what a variable, what a number, and so on is. And in terms of that, I think it is helpful if people have a kind of realistic idea by the also about the very nature of the sciences and mathematics and so on. This applies even more for, and I think in everyday context, it's more relevant in the context of, for example, chemistry or biology. There it's important to teach and to talk as much as possible about the very nature of scientific concepts. Well, that's what I just did when I talk about the historical changes of the concept of a variable.
Yeah, that makes sense. And epistemic beliefs tie into science communication and research in the way that I believe scientists in general, and I know that my knowledge is limited.
Yes, and also the ideas I have about what I can expect from scientists. For example, to have a very concrete example, when the COVID pandemic emerged, it suddenly became obvious that scientific evidence is evidence which is constituted by a kind of agreement within the scientific community. And this is aligns not with what students learn in school when they are confronted with parts of Newtonian physics or so. There it is said, well, it is, these are very well-established concepts, and the very fact that establishing these concepts is a kind of social agreement that is very, in a sense, it's very hard to grasp, because it is inherently true that these concepts are neither arbitrary nor pure invention, and that they reflect a kind of reality, the concepts of physics and the concepts of chemistry and concepts of biology. And on the other hand, simultaneously, they are kind of social agreements among researchers. And it's very difficult to, but also important to emphasize this dual characteristic of concepts, because if not these both sides are emphasized simultaneously, this is a kind of gateway of science denialists. This is what I had started with mentioning it. And I would like to come back to the COVID pandemic, because there it suddenly it was used by science denialists and all kind of conspiration theorists, so to say. They said, well, all these guys, they are not very clear about the COVID virus and everything, and so we cannot believe them. Meaning that only if there is a kind of clarity and final agreement on what a scientific concept is, that only if that is achieved, then it would be possible to work with a scientific concept. But in reality, that is not the case, especially when it doesn't come to something like new, like it has been the COVID virus.
I think that is also something I notice a lot, that also the updating of scientific knowledge is always kind of publicly perceived as the researchers have been wrong, but it's not necessarily that there has been things that were wrong, but more like we need to update, so we gain more knowledge, and with that more knowledge we can improve the theory.
Yes, I fortunately the surveys, as they've done, for example, with the in the context of the German Science Barometer, this large representative survey about Germans' perspectives on science, they show that typically this incremental nature of the production of scientific knowledge is not conceived in the public as being problematic. It is only when it is put into politically or ideologically contested context, then it suddenly could become a kind of counter-argument against the truth or the validity of scientific evidence. But in general, it can be, we can assume that at least Germans, it might be different, by the way, in the US, that's much more separated ideologically, but at least in Germany, you can say that the majority, if they have ideas at all about what science is and so on, are not totally confused, so to say, when they learn that these concepts are incrementally refined and changed.
That's very good. So you said that people are aware of these incremental updates, And generally, obviously, it would be good if the general public believes in science and the science that is communicated to them. How does that work? So how do you make people, how do you communicate science in a way that people can understand and believe it?
Well, let me jump to the first, to your first sentence. It's not that I would argue that it is, that someone from science or science communication should wish for a kind of gullible faith and public belief in science. Obviously, it would be necessary to have what I like to call a kind of informed trust. And this means that, of course, people are critical and they are vigilant against all kind of deceiving and preliminarity, so to say, of scientific findings, of course. But the problem, but what I mean is that such very concrete informed trust, meaning there's such a critical attitude, is then against what comes up as a new finding, which is then said by someone to be relevant for the everyday life of a citizen, that should be at least perceived and processed based on the general attitude, the general idea that science is an important voice, so to say, to tell us something about the real world. Because I mean, typically in everyday life, I mean, you are in a student and in study context, and I'm working in a study and university context, just as you. But typically, people live not in these contexts, but they live in contexts where they get information about issues, for example, of health or climate, and so from a lot of different sources. And science is only one of these different sources, and that's fine so far. So it is just, I think it is important for trust in science that people at least have a general positive appreciation and expectation about this kind of source of knowledge. And this general expectation could be then the kind of background, which of course is then concretely enacted. Often it could be for very good reasons that people are very critical. I mean, it's also obvious that not all what scientists say turns out to be true. Often it happens then that later it turns out things are nowadays seen in a different way than they used to be seen. But this does not mean, or it is helpful to deal with that if one starts with a kind of background mindset, so to say, which is rather appreciative of science. We call that, or one notion for that is typically positive if people have a kind of belief in the potency of science. This is a concept suggested by a U.S. colleague, I think, by the name Munro. He has suggested this notion of potency of science, meaning, well, it means what the word says, that people have basic belief that at least in principle, science is an important kind of mechanism, but also an important kind of social enterprise which produces reliable, or which could produce reliable knowledge, which sometimes, not always, but sometimes matter for real life decisions people have to make.
In school, often the focus in the science subjects is more on communicating basically the facts or what the science community sees as the current state of knowledge. Do you think it would be beneficial to also teach more of this social aspect of science, of the scientific method? Because I think if you don't study, you don't really learn about the social aspect of science after school.
Yes, I think it is. It would be very, very important and helpful to do that. And it is also, yes, I totally agree with it. It is, and it is also necessary to add, so to say, that what I mean with this. Because nowadays, in at least in the gymnasium, the syllabus already has a kind of emphasis not only on the facts, but also on the methods, how they are established, explaining what an experiment is and so on. But this is not the whole story, so to say, about this social nature of science. And that means when it comes, for example, let me get back to the COVID example, it is more important to learn why, in which way you can establish that Christian Drosten is more reliable than one of these esoteric guys who run these science denialists podcasts, which are existing, then explaining why the structure of the virus itself. And this has, but this has strong implication. If I'm starting to talk about why Christian Drosten is reliable, I have to talk about the social system of science. Why? What does it mean to become a professor and a director in that field where he works? And also to help that sometimes there are people who are professors and scientists in such institutions, but they are nevertheless talking nonsense. And but overall, this is less probable and things like that. Talking about that, you are suddenly talking not about germs, about the structures of virus. You are talking about a kind of social phenomenon. And I think it is necessary, it should be, that in chemistry and in biology and in science teaching, such topics also should be covered. Let me add that it's also clear, I think, I would clearly argue that a kind of basic understanding of the basic concepts in chemistry, biology, physics, and so on, that they are still necessary. It's not that I would argue, well, it's possible to talk only about these social structure of science, but I would like to emphasize that talking about the methods, and now I'm repeating what I already said, it's not enough, as it is said nowadays in the syllabus, at least in Germany, or more exactly, I recently looked up in North Rhine-Westphalia, in the state where I live in, that clearly says, yes, we have to talk about this concept in science, but then also about the methods. But it's not said also about the social structure of the real existing institutions in Germany. And that is what I think is necessary, because when people, when they are out of school and they are confronted with all these different voices telling them something, they have to decide whom to trust. It is not very helpful to have a grasp of understanding of what a virus is.
So in order for people to increase their trust in science in general, they not only need the information the scientists find out about, but also the concept where the scientists exist and do their research.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and in that very general sense, there's a kind of agreement nowadays in all kind of science educators, but I would like to radicalize that a little bit when I point to that this requires to teach about the real in the real concrete society which scientists are available there. Or to put it even more practically, I think it would be very helpful if in chemistry education, just to take an example, the teacher would not only talk about acid and about
bases
and bases, but also would take about which chemists nowadays are present on some kind of social media and what are they doing, and are there examples of those who are reliable, and are there examples of kind of freaks who are providing very strange theories, and to help students to deal with this kind of science in their media environment.
What can we as science communicators take away from this insight? So should we communicate more about the process of how we got to results? Should we make the social dynamics behind research and science more transparent, communicate that more instead of results?
Well, as I said, not in the sense of that results don't matter, but in this provocative answer would be science communicators should read a lot of newspapers. I mean, they should be aware about present conflicts and debates in the general public, which matter for science. This is what I. This refers back to what I said earlier when I said, "Well, the default value, or the default attitude people have against science, is neither very critical nor very interested." But people are not distrustful of science. They typically they have a rather positive, mildly positive expectation. It's only when there is a politically motivated or for other reasons motivated kind of science denialism that this problem occurs at all. And that's what I mean why it is necessary to read the newspaper, because it is necessary to understand, for example, to take a very concrete example, there's a clear put forward by the AFD when it comes to climate change. There's a clear, they have a clear agenda of science denialism. And in terms of that, it is, of course, important to be aware about that, about the political motives behind it and things like that.
That makes sense. Just for the people who might not be German, the AfD is the far right wing party in Germany. You also already touched on the fact that teachers shouldn't just communicate the scientific facts, but also maybe talk about science communicators, for example, on social media. So how do you think the popularization of social media over the last few years has changed and shaped science communication?
At least it offered the possibility of kind of discourse among citizens about science related topics, and of course it has always been the case also in the past that people are not alone, so to say. They talk with their grandmother and their husband or their wife about findings or about things they hear about science if it somehow matters for themselves. And nowadays the room and the number of people who possibly could involved in such discussions has enlarged, and this of course is an important I would say contextual condition, so to say, for science communication. But I, preparing my sentence, I realize in my mind that I have not or at least at present I'm not aware about studies which really show if there has been an increase on science-related topics as topics discussed in social media. I would assume that, again, this depends on events, on reasons for public interest in science, which typically comes from events and incidents which are out of science, meaning the COVID epidemic suddenly led to the effect that people got interested in science, while typically they are, for very good reasons, they have not been very interested in science, and that's fine so far. And I don't think that science should be having a missionary attitude, that everyone had a kind of knowledge and understanding, of science. I mean, carpenters also make their living. There's a kind of division of labor. It's also for carpenters not necessary that everyone is interested in the business and in the skills of carpenters. So in terms of that, I think it is fine then when people are interested in knowledge which has been shown to be valid by science, but it is not necessary that people are, in a very overarching sense, are interested in science. Why? I mean, science communicators often think so, but I think why? I mean, this has to be legitimated.
Yeah, I feel like for me it's that I'm interested in science myself.
Yeah.
I feel like this is also... So, I mean, we've talked to some science communicators for a winter special, and I think there's a large overlap of people who do research and do science communication. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that it is very helpful and it is very good for society when there are many researchers, but also journalists are interested in discussing and talking about science. This is quite clear, but I always think it somehow should be related to issues people really are interested in and are, and that there should be good reasons, so to say, and then that it is important for citizens to know about that and to be aware about that. It is, but I'm a little bit hesitant against the idea that that science as a realm of that all knowledge which is produced by science is this worthwhile and necessary, so to say, to sell it to the general public. Because, I mean, as I said, there's a kind of division of cognitive labor and a division of labor, and it is clear there are parts of scientific knowledge which are very important for the production of scientific knowledge, but which is not it's not necessary that all citizens know about that.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of science communicators are scientists themselves, and as we discussed in the beginning, if you want to work in that field, you need this curiosity. And I feel like, I guess sometimes science communicators, me definitely included, forget that this curiosity is not shared by everyone outside of this research.
I would like to be very clear. It is very good to advertise and to for that curiosity to find, to increase it, and so on. But on the other hand, I just want to say, just for the avoidance of disappointments and for a better and more rational discussion about what should be the aims of science communication, what should we achieve within the general public, so to say, as the attitude, as idea about science. In terms of that, I'm always emphasizing this other side, that the very idea that all scientific findings should be brought among the general public, that this is often implicitly, I think, taken for granted, and therefore I like to come up at least with two question marks, four or three.
We now talked a lot about the importance of trust in science communication, and also played a big role in your research on science communication. Could you maybe go a bit into how you research trust?
Yes, I could give you two examples. So one example is that we, for example, we studied in which ways people explain for themselves when they come across contradicting scientific claims. So this happens, of course. People try to find evidence about the, for example, the impact of sugar for health or something like that. And then they come across contradictory evidence or arguments, so not evidence, but arguments put forward. They find it easily in the internet. And what we studied empirically was the ideas people have, the, so to say, implicit theories people have, why that happens, why it happens that scientists contradict each other. And this is one of the research strands which we developed in our my former group in Münster, and which since then several other colleagues elsewhere, but also those who who used to be members of my group nowadays still work on trying to establish empirically why what people think, why people, why researchers contradict each other. This is one of the things which we studied. Another thing, issue which we studied were, so to say, the dimensions of trustworthiness. People, we were able to show that when people make judgments about why is a scientist trustworthy and more trustworthy than another, which dimension they refer to. And one of the interesting, in my view, interesting findings is that the overall pattern of reasons for trust and distrust, why do people distrust and trust, is the same, but the what really matters for judgments of trust and what really matters for judgment of distrust differs. So what we find is that for judgments of trust, the main, most important dimension is expertise, meaning I trust those experts who have the most knowledge, who are most skillful, and I distrust those experts who, where I have the strongest indication that they might have, that they are not benevolent, that they might have additional motives, so to say, working in their own pockets, so to say. This is, if there's, people are very sensitive against that. They are very, they are very sensitive against this smallest indication of this kind of non-benevolence, then the trust in the scientist immediately decreases strongly. But when it comes to, well, this scientist is very trustworthiness, but this one is even more trustworthiness, then it, what matters is expertise. So we have, by the way, now I already mentioned these three, two of the three dimensions which we found empirically. This is expertise, this is benevolence, these are the both I mentioned. Then somehow related to that is integrity, meaning do scientists adhere to their rules, so to say. And then there's a fourth dimension which we had not established by this, but the U.S. colleague John Beasley has additionally established the dimension of openness. And nowadays we also find that, that an idea of, is that a scientist willing to communicate? Is he able to communicate? And this is a fourth dimension which makes up or which impacts on trustworthiness, judgments. So we have these four dimensions. And this is the other, I think, relatively important finding which we had and which, by the way, since then are also somehow in a slight version part of the Wissenschaftsbarometer, the annual Wissenschaftsbarometer not in all years, but all very often has items representing these dimensions.
Could you briefly explain for the people who are not from Germany what the science barometer is?
The German science barometer is a annual representative survey about Germans' trust in science. It's a little bit comparable to there's a huge, there are in other countries comparable surveys, but the German science barometer is in a very similar and related way done, by the way, in Switzerland. They use the same, more or less, the same set of questions, and typically the survey questionnaire, it's a representative survey, as I said, has two parts. One is a part of the items, as I just mentioned, trust and the dimensions of trustworthiness. And then each year they are different. In addition, they use different items. For example, last year was about, I think, freedom, academic freedom, things like that. People's ideas about the role and importance of academic freedom. And this survey is done by a kind of agency which is independent from the government, but which is funded by more or less a mixture of public money and also money from private founders, foundations like the Bosch Foundation. But both funders they have no control, so to say, about the survey. The survey is done by a group of those who are hired for it. As I said, it's an agency in Berlin running that. It is done every year since 2017. So nowadays we have very interesting, always, we also could see a very interesting sequence. For example, you can say more or less one of the main interesting, they have five or seven, I've forgotten now, point scale on people's trust in science. And it shows that more or less 50 and 60% of the Germans typically say they have full or at least large trust in science. And it's only 20% who deliberately say they have deliberately no trust in science. So this is relatively stable, and by the way, it is quite similar to findings in other countries, for example, in Switzerland. And also in the COVID was interesting, there was a peak. In COVID, the trust in science increased. And then following years, it went back to that level, which I just mentioned.
One of the most interesting insights from the science barometer, because when I now reflect on the COVID times, it feels like this huge age of distrust and misinformation. But actually, I think especially in the beginning, there was this huge interest in scientific findings, like you mentioned in the beginning, and also interest in scientific findings and the process that wasn't as relevant before, I guess.
Yeah, and this is very interesting what you said, that there was and I also agree that if you possibly in social media, but also probably in the traditional media, you could have the impression there's a rise of public distrust in science. But these figures show that this is not true. As I said, the general attitude against science is mildly positive in among the general public in Germany. As I said, what is also very important is this relatively highly positive stance people have against science is shown by means of the general survey item asking do you, what is your trust in science in general sense? But if you ask not in that general sense, but what is your trust in science with regard to climate change or with regard to medicine or with regard to very specific topics, then the pattern becomes more nuanced and more differentiated. Then it is very clear that the general ideas and public attitudes about these attitudes, these fields, has a strong impact on the trust in science about these fields. So there are differences up to 10%, so to say, between public. In Germany, for example, trust in science in the context of climate change is relatively high. This is more in other countries. And so you have differences with regard to different fields, which could clearly be related to public discourse in the media discourse and political conflicts about that these issues. For example, Germany, when it comes to gene-modified food, people are, or there's a larger proportion of people who are critical against that than those who are critical against science in general. But to add that my interpretation is that this is not primarily that people are critical about the science of gene modification, they are critical about gene modification. And that is a difference.
Yes.
Often, sometimes it is, by the way, a fault and, in my view, pretty problematic point that this is confused in reporting about surveys. Then it said, well, oh, people don't believe the science of the scientific evidence about gene modification. Then I would say, well, often it's the case they have I'm not discussing if this is justified or not. It's just that I would say, no, there's a public opposition against gene modified food, and it's not a public doubt about the science of all that.
I could imagine that you would get similar results now about large language models, like that there's maybe a distrust in large, or not a distrust, but negative opinion in the public about large language models, but when they still might trust the science about large language models.
Well, this is a very interesting topic. At present, I'm starting a little bit to work on that. But I could say the last German Science Barometer, they asked about people's ideas about large language models, and at least at that time, meaning that it's the last survey, it's always done, I think, in August, something like that. I might be wrong, but something around that. Resulted in a rather positive result, meaning the surveyed German population at that time, there was a majority of Germans who had a rather positive appreciation of large language models, which I found very interesting, and I would not have expected that. But that is empirically the case.
So you said that you could see in the surveys an increased trust in science during the COVID pandemic in Germany. Do you have any ideas or theories why there was an increase in trust during this time, even though it was so difficult in many ways?
It's a good question. I would say, first of all, I would like to say that it was not. It's easier to talk about a hypothesis which is put forward and which I would say is wrong. There are colleagues who said, well, it's obvious that it's clear why this increase was. People were grasping for every straw they could get. I mean, there were. It's a kind of social psychology explanations. Things are very, the environment is very unsafe, so to say. The world is very unsafe due to the COVID, and therefore people rely on whoever is in authority. I don't like that interpretation, and I don't think that it is deep enough. I said it, you might remember, I mentioned already earlier in our interview, I said, well, nowadays, typically, people don't have reasons to think too much about science and too much about why should they and why should scientists always expect the general public should be very interested and enthusiastic about science. Of course, there are results which are very important to that everyone knows about it, but there's much science done where there's no reason that the general public should be interested in it and that one should blame the public for not being interested and so on. Given that, I would say that when it comes to, against that background, when it comes to COVID, suddenly, so to say, this part of medicine, which and epidemiology, also other fields which are related to coping with the COVID, for example, the psychology and education science, when it comes to the question of the detrimental impacts of closing schools and that, all the research around coping with COVID suddenly became very emergent and visible for the general public as relevant for the dealing with this new situation. And therefore, I think suddenly people became interested in it. And then, as I said, I mean, they started with a kind of preemptive assignment of positive expectations to science.
Do you think so during the COVID pandemic? I mean, Christian Drosten became Germany's most famous virologist. Do you think the scientists' willingness, like in the case of Christian Drosten, also supported this? That he basically immediately when this started, basically started doing a podcast and started explaining as much as he could about the pandemic?
Yes, I mean, this helped a lot. And I think it was very laudable that he did that. On the other hand, I would clearly say that this should not be taken as a kind of general expectation to all scientists, because I said that in another context, there is a kind of division of labor. And this also refers to science communication. To put it more general, as a rule, or to put it in a normative way, I would say the general public pays for scientists, at least when they are in universities or public-funded research labs, and therefore the general public, therefore it's a kind of duty that scientists, in a way, are open about their work to the general public. That's very clear. I think this is their duty as citizens and as scientists. But that does not mean, by no ways, that they themselves have to do this communication. It could also be that they are open for journalists who ask them, that they are willing to explain to other experts who are better in science communication what they are doing. So I'm emphasizing that because there are voices who sometimes argue that every scientist should be able and willing to do science communication. And I already said that I think this is not a very reasonable expectation. But as I said, everyone should accept and be willing and support as a scientist that he or she provides his or her research, gained information, insights, knowledge to those who somehow do science communication.
Yes.
In terms of that, Christian Drosten was an exempt. There are sometimes such intuitive, very good communicators, but by the way, he had to pay a hard price for it. I mean, you know, he was attacked personally. There were times where he needed police protection, and and all that. So I'm admiring him, but I would not argue that he is the kind of pattern for everyone.
No, and also, yeah, the cost for him, when I also read that he received death threats.
Yes.
For communicating about his science. So, yeah, I fully agree that we cannot expect all scientists to communicate their science themselves publicly.
On the other hand, at one of the conferences that I was at last week, I can't remember whether it was the WISCON or the Forum Wissenschaftskommunikation. I think at one of those we had a discussion about whether the podcast would have been as successful if it was the COVID-19 podcast by the Charité instead of the COVID-19 podcast by Christian Drosten. So if it was presented by this institution instead of this individual person.
Well, I mean, I would always say that for psychological reasons, it is necessary, it's always helpful to have a concrete person. I mean, in the televisions, you also have anchor men and anchor women representing a specific format. And this is one thing. And the other thing is, I told you about these features of trustworthy scientists when I talk about expertise, integrity, openness. In principle, these features also apply to if you ask people about science in general, not about scientists. In principle, it works also there. But as I said, from a social psychology point of view, it is obvious that messages and are easier to process, and to also that trustworthiness judgments are easier if they could be somehow assigned to individuals. Individual persons and to institutions. But I would also like to emphasize that it is necessary for them, for those individuals who are representing these institutions, that they themselves always emphasize very strongly that they somehow are part of a community. I mean, this in a way relates back to what I already said when I said that one of the main challenge of science communication is to explicate that science could produce a kind of, what I would call, with at least some hyphens, objective truth, and still is a kind of social agreement among scientists. And in order to emphasize that, it is important for the individual scientists to point also on the lab behind him or her and all the people around him. But as far as I remember, by the way, Christian Drosten always did that. He emphasized very strongly that, of course, he's interpreting. I mean, by the way, he often switched in the role of someone who was commenting research and synthesizing research, not only reporting his own research. And I mean, this could be scientists who have their credit and who are faithful and trustworthiness because they are doing their own research. But it could be also someone who's totally focused, for example, on putting scientific evidence together and presenting it. Nowadays, there are, for example, in science, as you of course know from psychology, we know that there are people who are mainly focusing on in their work on doing meta-analysis. They are not doing primary research, but meta-analysis, which is also a very important and valuable own kind of doing research.
Yes.
And which also would be in case of a could be a case of a scientist who, in his scientific work, does meta-analysis and simultaneously would do science or communication on that. This would be also very interesting.
Yeah. I just also thought, or I thought for myself, whether I had examples of people who are not actively researchers, but who are doing science communications, which I, like, individually perceive as trustworthy, just instinctively, not that I really looked into their beliefs outside or whatever. And what came to mind were the hosts of the Die Sendung mit der Maus, so a German, not necessarily just science communication show, but like a German education show for kids. And at least when I was young, you always had one of three hosts there, and you got to know got to know the hosts, and they became kind of authority figures on this educational content. And for example, I'm still following Ralf Kasper as one of the hosts, and look to his takes on certain topics.
Yeah. I think the Sendung mit der Maus is a very good example for a kind of science communication for kids. Yes, I would say.
What are the current hot topics in science communication research? What fields of science communication research are most prominent currently?
Well, I would say, at least in my view, what would be a hot topic, not meaning that it is actually, there's already nowadays, every day I get alerts on new papers which came out on that. And this is the impact of large language models on science communication. We already mentioned that very shortly. I think large language models are really new development. And with really new, I mean that we have had in the past always new social media and more generally internet-related developments, which somehow impact on science communication. But I think that large language models, so to say, are they are shuffling the cards in a new way. Or at least I would say they, in a way which has to be understood. And I would not claim that I really have understood it. I see it as a challenge for research on science communication to understand theoretically as well as empirically the impact of the availability of these large language models on science communication. Because And I think this is it has to be studied in the future for the very simple fact that in itself it will be, we are seeing at present that it is developing. So meaning that this impact could be in 1 year or 2 years different or much stronger than it is nowadays. But even nowadays, I think one could say someone has come to the table, so to say. Imagine a table where they are sitting the scientists, there are sitting the journalists hired by universities, which are in the, their job is somehow to communicate and to about the merits of their specific institutions. Then you have science journalists. So this they are sitting on the table. And then there are citizens who are interested, who are sometimes come and go back from the table because they are interested, as we said, when they are concerned personally by an issue or topic. We discussed that with reference to the COVID pandemic. But now there's an additional guy sitting on the table, and this is this are these large language models. And that I describe that deliberately in that human-like style, because I think this is the strength but also the very strange quality of these agents, that they act in that human-like manner. And I think we have to take that serious, that suddenly there is someone who has a very strange role in he or I refer to it now as he, this guy, large language model, he could do both. He could work, act like a science journalist. He could act like a scientist who puts together information. And often he is reliable, often he is not. And you have to somehow to figure it out. I'm not adding to the voice who say, oh, it's always very unreliable. I would say it's to my experience when it comes to issues which are not politically contested and where there's a large public internet available text basis on it. And also where the system, especially where the system is aware about possible denialists or denial voices, then it comes very up with very, I would say, high quality evidence. For example, if you ask, well, what are the main reasons for climate change, or what are the reasons for the assumption that that humans are strongly responsible for climate change, it came up with very reasonable and I think helpful responses. But of course, you can also come up with questions which would you provide with information which are misleading, of course. But as I said, overall, there's someone new sitting on the table, and we have to learn how to deal with this new guy hanging around at our table of where we process and argue about science communication. And I think this is a very interesting, I mean, for me as a researcher, it's very interesting to understand that better. And this is my response to the question, what is the, at least what I feel most interesting issues. And I give a little teaser. I have read recently several studies about the question about the quality of the responses and also about the public's trust in these responses. And I have very recently done small case studies where I asked the system if it morphed in science. I took that serious to take it as a like a human being, and then I gave the system all the question of the German science barometer, and I wanted to understand in which way the system responds to that. And I found that overall it has a little bit more positive general attitude about science than it has than the general public. I asked it also on the same scale as the science barometer does. But when I asked for the reasons to about, for example, reasons about benevolence, integrity, and expertise, it comes up with very reasonable textbook-like responses.
I just wanted to say, yeah, that's really, really interesting to look into or see what the system says about science. So I see a lot of research going into, okay, how do LLMs represent this and that? And yeah, it's a fascinating field. I think you also learn a lot about the AI system, but you also learn a lot about the underlying data.
Yes, I think so. I find that interesting, because if we take, I mean, we don't know exactly which data it uses, of course, but if it's true that it more or less harvests all kinds of documents found in the internet, then one could argue that the output is a kind of empirical data on what the social psychologists have called the social representations. This is a social psychology concept put forward by the French psychologist Moscovici, where he characterizes overarching, non-individual but cultural ideas which exist in a certain society at a certain point in time. These are the ideas about how the world is. He calls that social representations. And typically, for many years, it was only rather difficult to establish empirically these social representations, because you had to do in-depth interviews or surveys asking people. And nowadays, we have we could ask very simply the system, and then this will report you about what I would say will provide a kind of condensed version of the social representations about a certain topic as far as they are written, of course. I mean, I always would say the public opinions held by by individual citizens could be different from written documents, but of course both are somehow related. And if you are accept that restriction to the written and public available text, then I would say it's a very interesting tool to establish empirically the social representations, existing social representation in the society about a certain topic. In terms of that, I'm also very interested in large language models as a tool, as an empirical tool for establishing data on social representations.
There is actually one large language model that was fine-tuned on second physics experiments, and that basically trumps every other modeling attempt, behavioral modeling attempt in that area. It's called Centaur, and the research lab where I'm going to write my master thesis actually looks into how we can use it maybe as an artificial participant, or what we can learn from this model Centaur about human behavior.
Oh, that's interesting, but I had not fully understand in which ways is that trained?
It's trained on behavioral data on different experiments, on, for example, reaction time and so on.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I have read about that. Yeah, I see. Yes. Yeah, I found that a very interesting project. Yes.
Yeah.
But this is another, but that's really interesting, because it emphasizes the need to make these differentiations. When I talked about social representations, it is not about the real behavior of people, but it is about the media coverage of the real behavior. You are doing that with regard to, and it would be very interesting to compare both, by the way.
That's true, yeah.
So what would you say like a point or two that would be good to take away from this episode for people who have listened to us?
Well, first is the point I made. Trust in science. Science in Germany is not endangered, or it's not a real problem, but it could be easily come under pressure, so to say. This is one message. The other thing is that I would say trust in science is important, and it is important that scientists are thinking about that, but it's also relieving and therefore important to know that science, and in general, but especially scientists, are not really controlling in a psychological and social sense the general public trust in science. There are many other actors who impact on that, and scientists have to be aware about that, but they do not take the whole burden, so to say, of maintaining trust in science.
Okay, thank you. And usually in the end, we also ask, because we are a cognitive science podcast, generally speaking, how does cognition tie into your research about science communication?
Oh, I would say 100% or everywhere. I mean, because we are discussing about attitudes, about concepts, about understanding, and I mean, this is cognition. Yes. And of course, we have not deliberately talked about emotions, but these are also involves emotions, but emotions by the very definition itself have a cognitive element. And in terms of that, cognitive science is comes in here. And I'm aware that cognitive science is, and cognitive psychology is not the same. But I would also say that when it comes to cognitive science, this involves also aspects beyond the psychological aspects, aspects of the sociology of science and also of the epistemology of science. And I refer to all these, to these bodies of knowledge also already in terms of that. Cognitive science was present in every second of our interview.
Thank you so much for talking to us today.
It was my pleasure, and thank you for your questions.
This was Kaleidoscience. We hope that you enjoyed this episode, and we would love to have your feedback. You can rate our podcast and give us feedback on our Instagram account. Have a great week, and you'll hear from us again in 2 weeks. This episode was hosted by Imogen Hüsing and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Imogen Hüsing, Clara Kühne, Sophie Kühne, Sönke Lülf and Elisa Palmer. The music is from Jan-Luca Schröder and the logo is from Annika Richter.